Before I hit play on the klezmer music, just a quick message to ask if you're liking the Bagel Podcast. A personal recommendation goes a long way. Just imagine you're sat down for Seder night and struggling to find conversation. Sharing your love for the Bagel Podcast can be a haroset to help the maror go down. Also, do join the conversation and all that balagan at bagelpodcast.com. Anyway, let's get on with it. Hello and welcome to the Bagel Podcast, Pesach special. Whether you're listening to this with a candle and feather in tow, matzah in your mouth, or sodium-infused egg sloshing around in your bowl, may your Pesach be a great one. Honestly, I love it. The history, the arguments about the best Haggadah, the weird foods, the only time in the year when we go on a literal ramble rather than a metaphoric one. And yes, before you say it, I always share the chores. I do acknowledge, however, that this may be a difficult time for you as you attempt to forget your favourite leavened foods. I really hope that the Bagel Podcast doesn't conjure up the image of a freshly baked, straight out of the oven, oval of sesame-sprinkled doughy goodness covered in lashings of lox over a bed of creamy cream cheese, garnished with rocket, crushed black pepper and a dash of lemon with each rip, reminding you of lazy Sunday mornings. Because that'd be cruel. There's no talk like that on this episode. Instead, we have a broigus by focusing on kashrut as Pesach lost its meaning, but that's right at the end. We have Denise Phillips talking Pesach food, Rabbi Harvey Belofsky of Golders Green Synagogue and a BBC regular explaining why we lean in Talmud for Shmerels, and in a Bagel Podcast exclusive, I managed to track down a long-lost story of some Passover Mishnah. And for the Afikoman, I chat with Michelle Barnett about Gift Charity, a food bank in Hendon, which unfortunately is used quite a bit. But before all that Passover stuff, in what is almost exactly the opposite of Manish Tana, this week is exactly the same as every other week with Netanyahu still Prime Minister of Israel. Gilad Halpin joins me from the TLV1 studios in Tel Aviv to discuss. How are you doing?
I'm so glad the elections are behind us. So glad. You know, if you could pay me money last week to be where we are today, I would take it. I didn't expect Netanyahu to secure such a safe margin. Manish Tana simile here is very apt because Netanyahu is, again, prime minister and he won pretty safe margin. Actually, exactly the same margin. 65 seats in parliament, which is what he had before. The difference is, actually, this is even a better result for Netanyahu because his majority in the previous Knesset relied on a centrist party, actually two centrist parties, but one of them in particular that wasn't 100% loyal to his shticks and antics. Now, that party called Kulanu, that was headed by a former Likud minister who broke away from Likud and formed his own party and was a finance minister in Netanyahu's previous government, their showing was reduced from 10 seats to 4. Now, since a prime minister needs 61-seat majority in parliament, and he currently has 65, it means that a party of 4 seats, which is what Kulanu is now, has absolutely no leverage on him. And talks have already started. By the time this podcast goes out, it may become a fait accompli that Kulanu is gonna merge back into Likud and be part and parcel of the party its head had left a mere few years before. What it means for Netanyahu is that all his attempts to legislate any sort of ruseful ways out of his impending indictment are more likely to succeed now than they did before, because he enjoys a majority of parties that are either loyal to him, predominantly Likud, with a faction of 36 MKs, which is an almost historic high, and other parties that are somewhat indifferent to the rule of law in the way that they don't really care much about the fact that the prime minister is facing very serious corruption charges. And until he's actually forced to stand down by means of a final conviction, which may take years to reach, they will not cast him out. So basically, Netanyahu is counting on that as the worst case scenario. Well, the worst case scenario is, of course, that he's kicked out. But for him...
Well, surely it's going to prison is the worst case scenario.
Sure, but you know what Netanyahu is counting on now is having a majority in parliament to secure his freedom, either by way of letting him serve until a conviction is reached, and hopefully somehow that will dissipate along the process. You know, a legal process could take a very long time, or by all sorts of other legislative tricks, such as extending and expanding his ministerial immunity, which is something that MKs and ministers have in Israel by law, because their immunity has to be removed in order for them to stand trial. So Netanyahu is counting on some sort of a majority that may not remove his immunity. Or there are all sorts of other retroactive attempts to legislate what is known in Israel as the French law. Apparently in France, there's a law that prevents an acting president from standing trial under any circumstances. So Netanyahu is trying to pass a similar law in Israel. It is very different, and I think it is pretty unlikely to pass, but you know, stranger things have happened in Israel, and stranger things probably will. In Israel, there's no term limit, so Netanyahu could potentially, and it seems more likely by the election, that he will serve as prime minister forever. It just doesn't add up and does not strike me as very legal, very constitutional. But there have been very serious attempts to erode the prevalence and primacy of the rule of law in Israel. It seems like, politically at least, Netanyahu could go ahead with whatever he wants to go ahead with. And it's incumbent on the law enforcement agencies, predominantly the Attorney General and the High Court of Justice, to try and somehow balance his power. But since there has been and still is, and it's probably going to increase now, such a huge pressure on them, you just don't know how long they can sustain it. What I think is the problem here is that people indeed, for their love of Netanyahu, have lost faith in the rule of law. And also, and Netanyahu, for his own sake, because he's trying, basically what he's got left now is the unbelievable support that he gets from his own political base that currently constitutes a majority of the Israeli public. So he's trying to leverage it against the law enforcement agencies that are so-called out to get him. What it means now is that he basically pits his own supporters against the other camp, which is the camp of the rule of law, whereas this definitely shouldn't be the case, and definitely shouldn't be the kind of culture, the kind of atmosphere that a head of government stokes. So what we're seeing here is an ongoing erosion and division between, and a distrust, most importantly, between the people and the state, you know, the state apparatus that it is there at the end of the day to serve them. If there is corrupt prime minister, that corrupt prime minister should not escape justice. I mean, it should be a very basic understanding for every Israeli individual, but it's not. And I think this is really the main danger for Israel.
So just before we finish, what does Israel look like in 2 years' time, politically?
I think pretty much the same as it does now. Yeah, well, you know, having spelled out all this gloom and doom, at the same time, or conversely, the democratic institutions of Israel have proven extremely robust. So I am not that pessimistic about what's going to happen. I am, though, slightly more worried than I was last week, because up until now, Netanyahu had some sort of checks and balances, political checks and balances, that he had to account for, and he doesn't anymore.
Gilad Halpern, thank you very much.
Thank you, Hayden.
And from Netanyahu leaning on his political chums to all of us leaning on Seder night, here's some Jewish learning for you.
Talmud for Shmerels.
So for this Talmud for Shmerels, I have the honour to be joined by Rabbi Dr. Harvey Belofsky of Golders Green Synagogue. In Golders Green, as the name suggests. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us today. So this is, as this is the Pesach special, what do you have for us?
Well, the tractate Pesachim deals with laws associated with Pesach, and the last chapter talks about the Seder. It's consumed with all kinds of details, which makes the Seder exactly as we know it to be. And one of the things it's interested in is this thing called leaning, hesevo. So at the Seder, you'll notice that people lean or recline. This comes from the Roman period, where people reclined on couches. And if you were free, truly free, rather than someone who was beholden to someone else, you would eat your meals lying on a couch in the Roman style, as you've probably seen in the movies. So as always, the Talmud's interested in how this works. So having told us that even the poorest person must have the resources to recline at their leisure at the Seder, it asks the following question. And for those who are interested, we're on page 108a of the tractate Pesachim. Here's a bit of the text. Itmar, it was said, Matzah tzarech hasevo, marach ein sevo, and tzarech hasevo. It was said that matzah requires reclining and morah doesn't. So matzah is about celebrating the Exodus. Morah is about remembering bitter times. So it's appropriate to recline while eating matzah, but not while eating morah. In fact, it would be quite inappropriate. Sit up straight and remember the bitter times. But then there's a disagreement. What do we do about the wine? There are four cups of wine, and the Talmud asks the question, should we recline while drinking the wine or not? And it comes up with a problem. Two cups you have to recline, and two cups you don't have to recline. So it wonders which way round it is. So there are two options, and the Talmud doesn't really resolve the question. The first two cups are before we actually go out to freedom, so maybe you should recline only for the last two cups. On the other hand, the first two cups are about the process of leaving. So maybe you should recline for the first two cups and not for the last two cups. So the Talmud, in true Talmudic style, says, since you've got two views, recline for all four of them. And that's what we do. But now there's the good bit. What is reclining? Sometimes they call it leaning, but that's not very comfortable. So it says the following. Parkadon. What is parkadon? It's probably a Greek loan word. And it means, according to the commentaries, lying on your back. Lying on your back does not qualify. It's probably pretty uncomfortable to try and eat or drink lying on your back. I don't know if you've ever tried to have a drink of water while lying flat on your back. It probably won't do you any good.
And Pesach has indigestion at the best of times.
That's right. So you don't do that. So that's not reclining. And Hesebos Yamin Lo Shema Hesebo. The Talmud continues. And reclining on your right side is not called reclining. Now that's a bit odd. It's not entirely clear why. And that's where the story becomes interesting. Then it says, Veloid, and this is the last bit of Talmud we're going to read. And not only that, Ella Shema Yaktim Kona Leveshet Viova Lide Sakona. Perhaps you'll end up choking, the food will go down your windpipe, and you'll end up endangering yourself. There's a very, very long tradition that you should recline only on the left. Because if you recline on your right, you might choke. The trouble is the science is not quite right. Because everything's about symmetrical. And the scientists will tell us that it's not any more likely if you recline one way or the other that you'll endanger yourself. So if you read the text very carefully, perhaps the bit that says you might end up choking, that's really referring to the first stanza, which says don't recline on your back. If you lie on your back, then it seems quite reasonable that you might end up choking. The food will go down your windpipe and you may well end up choking. So don't do that. Also, it's pretty uncomfortable. In which case, what's the reason that you have to recline on your left and not on the right? Well, there you go. You see, if you look in the commentaries, they will say the following. Most people are right-handed. And when you're reclining on a couch, not leaning at the table like we do in the modern times, but you're reclining on a couch, you're always going to recline so that you can use your stronger hand. So since most people are right-handed, the Seder wants us to recline on the left so that we can use our right hand. Of course, the difference between these two opinions will be what someone who's left-handed should do. If you're worried about choking, it's just unfortunate. You'll have to recline on the left anyway and be forced to use your right hand, even though you're left-handed. But if the reason is for comfort, if you were left-handed, you'd recline on your right side and you'd be able to with your left hand. So this is the kind of thing the Talmud's interested in. What this means is recline at your Seder, imagine you're free, think about being back in the Roman times, but realize that this very strange practice has a long history, lots of very interesting points about it, and it might make a difference whether you're left or right-handed.
Rabbi Harvey Belofsky, thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure. Have a good Yom Tov.
So whichever way you lean, Passover can be stressful. Here to give some tips on how to make the whole thing a lot more relaxing without sacrificing quality, here's Denise Phillips. So I'm joined by Denise Phillips for yet another round of cooking and history about food, because who doesn't like food? How are you doing today?
I am well, thank you very much. Well, the word Pesach and panic seems to come together, and I'd really like to take out that stress and make it, well, as far as I'm concerned, if you're well prepared and you know what you're making, you know what you're doing, let's take the stress out of making it and make it a pleasurable experience for the whole family. From the end of Purim, because we have 4 weeks to get our chometz out of the home, make it chometz free, is really God's way of saying time to spring clean. And it's a really good way of getting some structure into the home. But it, you need to remember it's a way of bringing Judaism into the home, bringing a mitzvah into the home, rather than an idea of spritz cleaning. But of course, we know we must remove all chometz from the home. Always write down the notes on Pesach menus and recipes that you've used in previous years and make a note of what worked well. I mean, if the family didn't like it, then don't make it next year. But if all they put the thumbs up and say, yes, we love this, then make sure you make it next year. Choose a Seder menu that is easy to serve, will not dry out if Seder service goes on longer than anticipated, as it always does. And leftovers will be fine for Yontif lunch, and especially Shabbos lunch too. I mean, if you're making two Sidurim again, you're going to be cooking on the Wednesday, Thursday. So what is going to last and look beautiful rather than wilting and sort of dried and not unpleasant.
Isn't that part of the Pesach joy? Some, you know, wilting, lifeless food. Isn't that part of what Pesach is about?
Not in my household, it's not. But choose recipes that are created KFP, kosher for Pesach. It's all very well substituting regular ingredients for Pesach ones, but they don't necessarily give the best results. Humility and dedication of what aspects of this is how you feel about what you're eating. It doesn't have to be unpalatable and really hard, dry. And, you know, you can't swallow sort of an unfortunate experience. But we, you know, make it pleasurable, make it memorable. We recreate. I mean, that's what the story of Pesach is all about. This, you know, reliving the time of the slaves. So they didn't necessarily go hungry. You know, they did have food. So do shop early and little Pesach tips, because you know, you will get the best variety. Avoid the rush and keep an eye on those special offers. After all, most supermarkets do. And I think there is a tendency to over-purchase on the matzah, because the minute Pesach is over, those big square matzahs don't go top of the list of, oh, I'm hungry, let's have a matzah. I think we avoid.
No, I love matzah. I eat matzah around the year.
I don't think we do, but we don't, you know, by when you start those big square ones, the little round ones, but the tea matzahs. But
no, I have the big square ones. I'm a weirdo. I'm a weirdo. Don't worry about it.
But buy smart is what I'm saying, and do not overpurchase on the kosher for Pesach items like the ketchup and the mayonnaise may be used, but there's items that once Pesach is over, you are not going to use. The potato flour, key example, you'll buy it on the baking powder and you're not going to touch it. And they're very clever, these companies, because they put the use and sell-by date a few weeks before the following year, so you have to throw it out and start again. Take advantage of what new and kosher, and be creative, and make it a really tasty experience. So a recipe that I love and have used for several years is my banana and date squares. So this recipe will be on the Bagel podcast, as well as my own website, and really it is using store cupboard ingredients. So it's when you think, oh, the kids are still hungry and we'll fill them up, or something for the lunchbox. It's got bananas and dates in it, as well as walnuts, zest of orange and juice, and it just cuts into squares and easy to take, easy to portable, and take it with you. So best dishes, Denise Phillips.
Thank you very much. And a link to the recipe is on the episode page at bagelpodcast.com. So whilst all the food on Pesach is great, not everyone has the same luxury. I went to visit a food bank that caters for the Jewish community to see what happens at this busy time of the year. I'm here at Gift Charity in Hendon. This is the headquarters of a multifaceted, multi-branched, huge charity, which we'll get onto in a minute, with founding director, Michelle Barnett. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, I must say, I've pounced on you. It's probably the busiest time of the year, right?
Yes, that's definitely correct.
Yeah, so it's the Sunday before Pesach. And I just thought we've been talking a lot on this episode about Kashrut and about the kind of the obligations of Kashrut and how expensive that makes it. And this is quite interesting because there seems to be two bits at the moment. One is trying to get people to offload all their chometz. And then the other one is helping people out with Pesach stuff, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. So it's a busiest time of year because what we're trying to do is collect all the surplus chometz food that people have and they can give us. So there's cereals and flour and crackers and pasta and basically anything that people want to get rid of before Pesach. Some people will just close it off in their cupboards and just seal their cupboards. But there are quite a number of people, especially in Northwest London and Hackney or Stamford Hill, who will want to get rid of everything from their house. And that is perfect for us because we will take it all, very gladly accept it, sell it through local Rabbonim, seal up our warehouse. And after Pesach, we will give it out to hundreds of families that are relying on our help for food parcels.
And are these Jewish families or is anybody?
We mainly help Jewish families because I think we're one of the only Jewish food banks around. But there are a couple of non-Jewish families that have been referred to us. And as we do get non-kosher food from time to time, we're very happy to give them whatever we have by way of non-kosher food.
And have you found that demand's getting higher for what you do?
Yeah, we get referrals from loads of different welfare charities, and particularly at this time of year, we get loads of referrals coming in. People just literally just can't cope for one reason or another, either family breakdown or they have illness or mental health problems, just loads of different reasons. And it's amazing. We're just very glad that we can be there to help them and support them.
I must say this operation is, and I've taken a few photos which I'll post on Instagram and you can see it there, but this is a very organised operation. It's not like bags of stuff everywhere. Like you can easily get to whatever anyone needs, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've been going for about 15 years. And when we first started, it was just bread, surplus bread from bakeries. And then we thought, well, we're giving these families that are struggling food. Wouldn't it be amazing if we could give them decent food, food that would really make a difference, nutritious food? So then we actually launched the gift boxes outside the kosher shops. And at the time, shopkeepers were saying, no, it's not going to work. Don't do it. You know, they're just going to get full of rubbish. And it's music to our ears 10 years later when shops phone us and say, oh, gift boxes are overflowing, come and collect them, which is fantastic. Gift is actually not about helping those in need. It's actually, our focus is on inspiring and providing young people with volunteering opportunities and inspiring them to become givers. So the whole purpose is to get young people, particularly young people, but any age, really giving, thinking of others at any time in their lives, during festivals, during birthdays, just any day, really, just to be giving to others. Also volunteering opportunities for hundreds of volunteers across the whole of London to collect food from shops, to pack up in our warehouse in Hendon, deliver food parcels. And it's not just about food. We have other volunteering options, getting kids helping after school, tutoring kids, helping with families that are struggling after school, and Worcester hospital services, and loads of other different volunteering opportunities.
So, how can you find out about the opportunities?
So our website is www.jgift.org. That's jgift.org. Our phone number is 0208-457-4429. We have an office in London and in Manchester and in Israel. We're always in need of volunteers for one reason or another. Please get in touch and we'll get you volunteering.
Pleasure to be here, Michelle Barnett. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And please make sure you do support them because they're great. I love the place and I was properly inspired. So get along.
The Bagel Broigers.
Before we start the Broigers, or as I'm calling it for Pesach, the Matzah Broigers. Sorry. I found a long-lost Passover Mishnah story. And do you want to hear it?
Yes.
After 10 plagues, the cries of the Egyptians rang out as they'd been put through the ringer a bit, thanks to Pharaoh's hardened heart. Their screams echoed all the way to the Hebrew quarter. Right, Shmuelesses! We need to go now! Yalla!
Why is everyone crying?
Because their firstborn children have died because they didn't put lamb's blood on the doorpost. Wait, what? You know this, we sacrificed a lamb. What's an innocent lamb done to us? Look, we don't have the time. I admit I found that a bit hard to handle myself. Oh, fine. I just tell you again, because we Hebrews believe there's never a bad time for a good education. We smeared lamb's blood across our doorpost to show we have faith that God would pass us over with the whole killing of the firstborn thing. That's a bit weird, but okay. Wait a minute, what about Mr. Jacobs? He doesn't have any family and just did his back in schlepping some stones. God knows what's in all our hearts, he was not required to do this. Well, if God knows anyway, why do we have to do the blood thing? To symbolise our faith. That poor innocent lamb. Now, let's stop talking, Shmuel Assis, and help your mother with the cooking. Ooh, what are we making? Well, we don't have much time, so we're baking flatbread. I love a good pitter, but why are we baking bread when we've got perfectly good lamb? I don't think God would be pleased with our wasteful nature. It takes time to cook. But we killed and drained the lamb hours ago. It would have been soft and tender by now. Can you please stop talking now, Shmuel Assis? One last thing. Do you think people will remember this day? Forever and ever. And do you think they'll remember it with tender lamb in pitta with hummus, tahina and Egyptian salad? No, of course not. They'll remember it with the mild inconvenience of many sets of plates and cutlery which they'll change for 1 week only, and their religious leaders will create a long list of unnecessarily expensive alternatives to real food for a week so that they can feel as poor and bloated as we do now. Oh, okay, that makes sense. And with that, they all joined their kin on the Exodus. So that was from a newly discovered religious text, the Shulchan Aruch HaHeiden. It'll help us with this episode's Matzah Brigus, which is, by focusing on Kashrut, has Pesach lost its meaning? I'm joined by Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers from Reform Judaism, Rabbi Jeff Berger, the founding rabbi of the Rambam Sephardi Synagogue, and Amanda Bukatz, who is a member of the United Synagogue, who does all the Mishigas of Pesach. Sorry. Should have been a bit more neutral. How are we all doing?
Excellent.
We're good.
Your story reminded me, I was recently asked by a very high-ranking member of Christian clergy if we still offer a Paschal lamb at Pesach. And I'm quite relieved that we don't.
So how do you pick the level of kashrut for Pesach? How is that picked?
I think it's really interesting because I remember growing up, I had friends who would keep almost nothing year round. And then at Pesach would go to Kosher Kingdom and buy everything for the week in Kosher Kingdom, spending an absolute fortune. And for some reason, there was something about Pesach kashrut that was compelling, where kashrut for the rest of the year really wasn't important to them. Mm. I felt like in my family growing up, we were sort of a middle pegging year round and Pesach was the same. You know, we changed over dishes and we bought some matzah but we didn't go mad for products. And having done our kosher outlet shop for the year, I do feel like we buy a lot more convenience food now than we did when I was a kid. And actually, Pesach could be a lot simpler
if you just did without it.
Right. If we focused on vegetables and fish and meat and potatoes and in Sephardi families, rice. But there is something that compels us to panic and think that, you know, we're going to need all this stuff for the kids. And I do it too, even though in my head, I know I should just eat lots of salads and meat.
And it's a week long. It's almost over by the time you finish the Seders. We did our weekly shop and we got two large briskets, plus the most expensive item probably was the box of handmade shmura matzah at £28 for about 12 or 15 slices.
And hopefully they're all whole.
Yes, hopefully. But it has to be said that there are lots of ways of getting through the week with the same foods that you normally buy, the vegetables, the meats, the cheese, as Rabbi Debbie was just saying, and leaving out the gimmicks. Because, I mean, we don't need them. We, for some reason, are fooled by the marketing, or we are perhaps panicked into thinking that we're not going to have enough food to leave us feeling sated, but I find that it'll be healthier if you just stick to the same diet. Why change it up?
Yeah, but some of the cakes are great though, aren't they?
I can't comment. I don't eat sweets.
I don't think the cakes are just great. I also think there's something wholesome about the baking process, and my mother-in-law coming over and doing the baking with my daughter and my son, and passing on those traditions of egg whipping and egg separating endlessly. I mean, the amount of eggs one goes through is a burden. I think the hens must start laying in January for Pesach. We don't make those kind of efforts week to week, but there are specialities about Pesach, and it doesn't feel like Pesach if you haven't got an almond macaroon
or a cinnamon ball.
My kids always, when I start the cinnamon balls, now it smells like Pesach.
I have to say, some of our fondest memories as children were sitting in the kitchen and being given the privilege of mixing up the batter of those instant cake mixes. And before they got into the oven, probably consuming half of what it is that we had produced.
Of course. That's half the joy of it, right?
And you asked me, why would I spend £28 to buy a box of handmade matzah? Because I can't find someone who will make it for less. I think the issue around Pesach is that there's something that touches the depth of the Jewish soul. The idea of chametz on Pesach is one of the, you know, the big ones. It is punishable by karet, which is, you know, excommunication or excision from the community. And part of it is tied into this idea of Jewish identity, that the Jewish people became a nation at Pesach. It's not that we were Abraham, Jewish individuals, you know, circumcision or what have you. This is big. This is the whole nation. And I guess there's a sense of awakening that people, no matter how religiously observant they are during the rest of the year, they will somehow or another make sure that...
There's loads of big moments, though. Seemingly, every time I go to shul, you know, the rabbi goes up and just goes, this is a very big and important week and moment. You know, so there's loads of them. And it's just interesting that Pesach's the one that sticks. I suppose maybe it's the drama of it.
There's this struggle and you don't feel as though you've done it properly unless you've struggled, unless you've put all your maximum effort and you get to Seder night completely on the verge of collapse. But we sort of, that's what we spend the whole evening talking about. And I suppose... traditionally, the mother, the wife, will be the one that's standing for 16 hours straight making knedlach and whatever else goes into our Seder menu. But I wouldn't feel genuine sitting down to Seder having not... I can't imagine going away. I've never done it. I can't imagine going away for Seder night and sitting in a hotel. How can you feel like you've struggled and fought when you're sitting down being served food that somebody else has cooked and no one's had spent 15 hours with their... elbows up to oven cleaner.
But then would the rest of your family say the same thing? Have they struggled in the same way that you have struggled? Mm.
So I have lots of teenagers and they are on potato peeling duty. We, for the last few years, have made little potato pyramids to go on, like mashed potato, and you form them. So that is what the teenagers spend sort of the erev doing. Boiling, mashing, and forming potato pyramids, and then sort of marking them down with forks.
You've not made it easy, have you?
Well, no, I haven't. But then by the time they have done, and we've got a big Seder, we've got 26 coming.
Oh, lovely!
So we're talking probably 70, 80 potatoes worth of potato pyramids. They feel like they've struggled, yeah.
I mean this with respect, but you're mad.
Indeed.
Not only that, but Amanda won't use a dishwasher.
No.
So at least after Seder, I know I can put everything in the dishwasher and walk away because we looked into the halakha of... But there are lots... You know, there's a Sephardi Ashkenazi divide, particularly with dishwashers, I think, about whether these things can be koshered. And the Sephardi kosher and obviously the reform approach, we've made a lot of effort to look at making sure you can buy simple, plain foods, particularly in the Sephardi tradition. If you buy it before Pesach, if you buy it plain olive oil, it doesn't actually have to be Hechshed olive oil. If you bought it before Pesach, before you've done your annulment.
Can I put my fingers to my ears at this point? Say, la, la, la.
and the same is true for sugar and salt and lots of other things. You know, kosher for Passover, aluminium foil is just absurd.
So I understand, say, butter, right? So you're putting your knife from the butter onto the toast and it goes and you get during the year and you get the toast. So having fresh butter makes perfect sense to me. But salt, you're not, unless you're the type of person that dips salt, but I don't think many people do, you're actually pouring salt on, you're pouring oil on. So why does it need to be fresh for Pesach? I don't get it.
No, for me and I'm only speaking for me. I'm not speaking on behalf of a community. But I want everything to be Herrchen. So that butter isn't just new. It's not just a new pack of supermarket brand butter. It has a Herrchen on it. Everything at Pesach will have been supervised from beginning to end. Otherwise, it doesn't come in the house.
Right, but like round the year, and this is on the KLBD website, so the London Beth Din website, for those who don't know the abbreviations, says that butter's fine. Any butter's fine. So
not on Pesach.
Why? What's happening in the butter churning process? Where is the chometz there? Because it's just like, it's milk, right? It's just milk turning around. So if you can't have your shroel, fine, that's another matter. So if you need it pure, but what is the...
But who's standing there making sure that the person who's churning the butter, or the person putting the butter into the tub, or the person manufacturing the tub itself, isn't just having a quick sandwich at his desk at the same time? And that crumb, it's fine through the year. It's a 100 in the 360th or whatever it is, but not at Pesach. There's that extra stringency that I will not... That thought that anybody has been anywhere near the production of my food with anything other than latex gloves.
I just think of Gollum from Lord of the Rings just getting like, dirty, dirty chometzes. Yeah, that's all.
I'm totally going to hear that voice now. Thank you.
Yeah, and technically, if it was butter that was made before Pesach and accidentally some chometz fell into it, as long as it was... 60-to-1 ratio, it was out proportioned, it would still be usable on Pesach. I know this is going to shock you. I'm sorry to say, but
you hear these stories of a finger turning up in a can of baked beans or whatever it is, right? That won't happen with your... This is not going to work, is it? With your kosher for Pesach baked beans? Obviously not.
You wish they would do kidney or baked beans.
Right. Well, I wouldn't have them any. But whatever, it's not going to happen that with your Pesach version of Cheerios, whatever that's called.
Right.
It's not going to be there isn't going to be a fingernail. There isn't. Everybody has been particularly...
I think a fingernail's probably okay. Or is it a fingernail power?
What's under the fingernail?
Yes. But I also, I don't want to disabuse you of the idealistic image of someone standing there over the factory process for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or as long as it takes them for their production run, to make sure that no chametz falls into the vat. This is kashrut. There's somebody who's probably come in and observed the manufacturing process, but they're certainly not standing there watching at every moment.
Unless it's Shemora, right?
Right, unless it's... Which is why you pay £28 for it.
For me, there's something really interesting about the different ways that we all go at this, which is that actually... I love that Amanda loves doing what she does and getting what she gets. And I think if it does it for you, then you should embrace it and you should do it. Mm. But I think it's also important that people for whom this feels unmanageably depressing and enslaving, if you're not finding that moment at Seder going, oh, I've done this and it's been amazing despite the 72 potatoes I had to boil for the pyramids, then there are options. There are other ways. There was a tweet I saw today from a guy who wrote, started my Passover shopping today. I bought a quarter of what I need for the week and it's already cost me double my usual weekly shop. If the community wants young families to keep kosher over this period, something has to change soon. You know, we've talked about some of the ways that these things can be managed without that expense. But if that's how people are feeling about their Pesach, we have to empower them to know that Pesach doesn't have to be that. It can be that if it does it for you. Mm. But if being able to buy stuff before Pesach that's off the shelf and, you know, having your box of matzahs and your regular Tesco butter to spread all over it because it tastes so much better that way, it doesn't have to break the bank and it doesn't have to be an enslaving process.
To be honest, I'm irritated this isn't more of a Bruegger.
We're trying to give you some solutions.
I don't want solutions.
Well, by the end of this, Amanda's not going to eat in my house anymore.
But her children will probably want to come and eat in your house.
The reason why, and it's one of my bugbears, and it's the reason why I picked this topic, was people who wish each other a kasher lePesach, as if that's the most important part of Pesach. It's not about remembering the Exodus. It's not about remembering, you know, the whole, you know, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat type of shtick. And then if for whatever reason might be legitimate, might not be legitimate, for that reason someone can't or isn't completely kasher lePesach and there is a crumb of chometz or even more than a crumb of chometz, then by saying that, You're actually putting someone on the back foot. You're saying to them, well, you're less of a Jew because, you know, you didn't hoover up properly.
Well, we're pretty used to that in the Reform community, hearing those kind of accusations.
Right, we don't accuse anyone of
that. Sure. And I think, actually, for me, I would love to reinvent the Pesach greeting to, you know, may you have a freeing Pesach and may you uplifting. Be uplifted and may Pesach really help you connect to the things that you need to be freed from. My favorite part of Pesach actually is the cleaning and the burning of the chametz. I think there's something really powerful in taking bread, which we threw away at Rosh Hashanah, at Tashlich, and named our sins. And when we take our chametz and we burn it, to name again, what are the things that we've still not sorted out since we threw them away? Rosh Hashanah, to have that moment of spiritual checking in and actually helping people connect with what the spiritual technology of these rituals are is one of the things that we're not always very good at. And you know what? I think if people haven't, for me personally, if people get to where they want to be with the food, that's great. The food is important because we're Jews and they try to kill us, so let's eat. But I'm much more interested in people connecting to what Pesach can do for them in their life, how it can transform them, how it can connect them to our story and to our sense of peoplehood and what it means to be as a Jew today, how we walk from Pesach to Shavuot, where at Shavuot we celebrate responsibility and that we're going from freedom to responsibility. What does it mean to take my freedom and help make that greater in the world? Because there's a lot of enslavement going on in the world at the moment. There are lots of ways of adding modern symbols to the Seder to connect people to it. But actually, the ancient story also has a lot to connect us to if we know how.
So my take on it is probably much more simple. But a lot of Judaism and a lot of the Judaism that I grapple with all the time is abstention and then reward or delayed gratification. So Shabbat is all about, no television today, no television, 8:43, now we can have television. There is nothing, and I don't care whether it's the immediately Motzei Chag or the next morning, there is nothing like that first piece of toast after Pesach. There is nothing like it. And when do we ever appreciate the simple food of bread? We've gone through that week and we've kept it really kosher. And then we get our reward because that first loaf and a half of toast in our house, two loaves sometimes, it's miraculous.
It's a really interesting distinction, isn't it? There's the one approach of we must suffer and then yay. And the other one is just yay. You know, it's like celebrate. It's a really, and it feels like, you know, if you wanted to separate out Sephardic and Ashkenazi approach, that'd be one way of doing it. it's interesting though, because I'm as Ashkenazi comes. And so I kind of share that pleasure in the suffering. Yeah. But I'm trying to become. I've married into someone who is pretty Sephardic. So I'm now trying to engage with the joy there instead. So I'm now spiritually torn. But I feel like that's just Jews, right? So I would just like to thank very, very much Rabbi Debbie Young Summers, Rabbi Jeff Berger, and Amanda Buchatz for joining me here. And I feel like we've got somewhere. We've spiritually evolved. Well, I've spiritually evolved. I can't speak for anybody else. Thank you very, very much for your time. And have a kasher. No, not a kasher Pesach. Have a meaningful Pesach where we remember that we suffered in a positive way and we eat lots of food that doesn't necessarily have to have come from any expensive kosher manufacturer. So that's it, Bagelers. Until next time, have a great Pesach. Or if you're one of our honoured Gentiles listening in, have a fantastic Easter. Or just chilling out, whatever it is that you do. Take care. Bye-bye.